Hello, I'm Michael Kukura, and this is number 0537, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0537. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, NASA expert Rod Pyle is back on the show to talk about the old space race. Why did the Soviets abandon their goal of reaching the moon? One reason was they had some spectacular failures.
They were having these terrible problems. Once Apollo scored lunar orbit with Apollo 8 and then lunar landing with Apollo 11, there was still some forward momentum to try and show that they could do it as well. But at a certain point with that big moon rocket failing, it just didn't make sense to continue. So they decided to go ahead and start doing something that they knew they could do, which is loft space stations. They did get the first space station up in 1971.
Another returning guest is Angela Crocker. She has a new book out called Digital Life Skills for Youth. Since she's written a lot about technology and she also has a teenage son, was this book born out of necessity?
My frustration came in the school talks that were given around kids and technology. And many of them focused on the scary element. Yes, cyberbullying happens. Yes, youth are being asked to provide nude photographs. Yes, there's catfishing. There's all of these big, big, scary things. However, there was very little day-to-day advice that I had observed. The reality is that our teenagers need to move from childhood to adulthood and know how to function in terms of technology. We can't protect them from it, so I'd like them to develop those skills.
Brad Schreiber is the author of Music is Power, Popular Music, Social Justice, and the Will to Change.
I think it's a combination of my last two books, to be honest with you. 10 years ago, I wrote Becoming Jimi Hendrix from the research of a Hendrix historian, Steve Roby, and that was about his early career. And then 3 years ago, I wrote Revolution's End, which is the inside story of the formation of the Symbionese Liberation Army, which you'll recall kidnapped Patty Hearst. And that book's all about the CIA and Black Panthers and experiments on black prisoners and very political. So I thought this time, why don't I merge the two?
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0537, was Michael Kukura, an old college friend and later a colleague at a local television station. Thank you very much, Michael, for doing the guest Slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even better and bigger radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? 32-year-old Gregory McDonald rented a U-Haul truck and says the West Palm Beach, Florida police never returned it. The company said they contacted McDonald 10 times over the course of a year, asking him to return it, and when they didn't get results, they called the police. It took another year to locate the vehicle, still in the West Palm Beach area. Police contacted McDonald, who allegedly said that he was the renter and his property was still in the truck. He was arrested, relieved of duty, and put on administrative leave at his job. His job, you ask? A police officer at the West Palm Beach Police Department. Wow. It only took 2 years to crack this case. How long would it have taken if McDonald wasn't on the police force himself? And you know, if his stuff sat in the truck for that long, he really didn't need the stuff or the truck. Yeah. It was a quick, well-coordinated raid. Three men wearing disguises swarmed into a jewelry store in Burnsville, Minnesota, armed with sledgehammers, smashed the display cases, scooped up inventory, and made a quick getaway in a stolen van. They might have never been caught, except for one thing. One of the items that they stole was a small electronic device, a GPS tracker. It led police directly to their hideout, and 28-year-old Markel Lamar Evans, 26-year-old Antoine DeVille Scott, and 19-year-old Trevin Shakur Edwards were taken into custody and charged with first-degree aggravated robbery. Well, if you think they were aggravated during the robbery, how do you think they feel now? After losing in district court, 66-year-old convicted killer Benjamin Schreiber took an unusual claim to the Iowa Court of Appeals, but was shut down again on November the 6th. Schreiber was sentenced to a life term in 1997, but in March of 2015, he suffered a medical emergency in his prison cell that caused doctors to have to restart his heart 5 times. Schreiber thus claimed he had briefly died, and therefore he had served out his life sentence and should be released. The district judge didn't buy it, though, saying the filing proved that he was still alive, and the appeals court agreed, saying Schreiber is either alive, in which case he must remain in prison, or he is dead, in which case the appeal is moot. Well, you have to give him some points for giving that theory a try. Although, if I were the appeals court, I would have altered the verdict a little bit by saying Schreiber is either alive, in which case he must remain in prison, or he is dead, in which case we either have to bury him or cremate him. I'll bet that verdict would get his attention. Yeah. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, 73-year-old Professor Bruce Bagley of Florida's University of Miami was a go-to expert in Latin American organized crime and the money laundering that gangs use to reap their proceeds. He wrote several books on the subject himself and contributed to many others, and also testified in court as an expert witness. However, Bagley has been arrested. He has been indicted by a federal grand jury after he opened bank accounts for the express purpose of laundering money for corrupt foreign nationals. Eric Cruz, an attorney who used Bagley as an expert witness in a case, called the charges pretty shocking and noted that when he was in college, he took a drug trafficking in the Americas class from Professor Bagley. I remember him telling the class, "It's not a how-to course, it's a historical review." Right. I guess the how-to course was only for grad students. You know, this really brings into focus the old adage of those who can't teach. I guess you could also add, and testify. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? There's a science fiction series on Apple TV called For All Mankind. It dramatizes an alternative history depicting the Soviet Union winning the space race to the moon. Now, that scenario got me to thinking about the actual space race that America won. I had one burning question. Why did the Soviets abandon going to the moon after the Americans got there? To talk about this, we're joined once again by Rod Pyle. He's the editor-in-chief for Ad Astra magazine, which is published by the National Space Society, and he's the author of more than a dozen books, including First on the Moon, the Apollo 11 50th Anniversary Experience. Rod joins us once again from California via Skype. Hi, Rod.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being on the program with us. When I was thinking about this question, you're the first person that came to my mind as to who could possibly answer it. So I know you probably have watched the Apple TV show. I have not watched it because I don't have Apple TV. But I see the commercials for it all the time, and that question keeps ringing in my mind. Why did the Soviets not continue their journey to the moon?
It's a really good question, and one that we weren't even really able to answer until after the fall of the Soviet Union, when some of that history became more available. So at the time, up through the late 60s, obviously we landed Apollo 11 on the moon in 1969, but we were working hard to get there. And in fact, the whole reason Apollo 8 went to the moon as early as it did, which was December 1968, was partly kind of a Hail Mary pass by NASA, because the CIA had shown them information, pictorial information from satellites, showing this huge rocket being moved out to a launch site in Soviet territory,
And they thought, you know, we're really not clear where they are on their program, but that looks like a moon rocket to us. And in fact, that was their intended moon rocket. It was called the N1, about the size of the Saturn V, about the power of the Saturn V. And the Soviets, in fact, had been working on lunar landing technology to carry people there since about the time shortly after Kennedy made his announcement for NASA to do the same. So they worked very hard, as it turned out. They did build and design and build a lunar lander, did some limited testing on it, designed and built their moon rocket. The problem was, and they had suits and the whole thing, you know, they're ready to go, and their lander would carry one cosmonaut down to the surface, and that was going to be enough to get out, get some rocks, do a little exploration, and come home. Looked like it could work. The problem was their big rocket didn't. So they tried to launch that four times, at least once, maybe twice. I can't remember the exact dates, before Apollo 11, and then a couple of times after. And every time, something went wrong. So the Saturn V had five main engines on the first stage. The Soviet rocket had upwards of 30. And they had a very primitive computer system trying to control firing all those engines at once. But this was the 70s, and even, or the late 60s, rather. And even for that time, their computer technology was lagging well behind ours in most ways. So it was just really difficult to get them synchronized. They had problems getting them all to fire accurately, and they were having specific problems with some of those engines. So those rockets would either misfire or explode. In fact, one explosion wiped out most of the launch pad and some of their top technicians, because, you know, a rocket that size is one of the largest non-nuclear explosions you can make. It's upwards of, I think, 8 kilotons, excuse me. And so they were having these terrible problems. Once Apollo scored lunar orbit with Apollo 8 and then lunar landing with Apollo 11, there was still some forward momentum to try and show that they could do it as well. But at a certain point, with that big moon rocket failing, it just didn't make sense to continue. And so they decided to go ahead and start doing something that they knew they could do, which is loft space stations. They did get the first space station up in 1971.
Mm. So as you say, it didn't make sense, or in this case, it didn't make rubles, I'm guessing. Was part of it the cost?
It was expensive, and there were political ramifications. I mean, they always tried to time their space spectaculars to some kind of anniversary, whether it's, you know, the founding of the Soviet Party or the Communist Party or something of that nature. And it just wasn't coming together. The other problem they had was, we had, in the American system, we had NASA, which would hire aerospace contractors all over the country and oversee what they did and design a lot of the stuff with them. And then they collaborated very well, but all under one roof, which was NASA, to create the moon program, upwards of almost 500,000 people. On the Soviet side, they had these competing design bureaus that had evolved out of the military structure, and the program was still overseen by the military. But the people running these design bureaus didn't necessarily get along very well, so there was a competition. You know, one company or one design bureau would be building some of the rocket technology, and the other one might be building the lander technology. There were actually competing rocket programs going on, and it was not a friendly or a wholesome competition, and there was a lot of politics going on in the background, so it really reduced their efficiency, at least when you compare it to what NASA did during the Apollo years, and that was another big part of it.
Okay, so we know that they couldn't go after the fall of the Soviet Union because there just wasn't any dollars, and Russia wasn't the Soviet Union anymore, so to speak, from that right. perspective. But what about the time between the last space mission when basically, or the last Apollo mission, I should say, when basically right. the Americans abandoned the idea of going to the moon for literally decades now? What about between that time period and before the fall of the Soviet Union? Was there no interest in Russia going to the moon since America had basically abandoned that idea?
I think that was the general sense of it. And they were having a fair amount of success in Earth orbit. So they had built a series of space stations called the Salyuts. They were originally called Almaz, and then that evolved the Salyut. The difference was, one was specifically military for spy purposes, and the Salyuts were more on the public end of their program. And they had had a good run of a series of those. They were small. They weren't as big as Skylab, but they were very effective, and they worked. And then by the 1980s, they had Mir, the Mir space station up there, which was their first modular station So although we had flown Skylab in 73, we wouldn't have a modular space station up until the international effort of the International Space Station in the late 90s. So it made sense to just keep doing this work in Earth orbits. So they were having very long duration missions up there where people would stay up for hundreds of days and able to conduct a lot of zero-G science and biomedical studies. So I think at that point, it just made sense to focus on staying in low Earth orbit. And it was a lot less dangerous and risky and expensive than trying to go out into the region of the moon. They did send an unmanned spacecraft that actually got into lunar orbit about the same time as Apollo 11. And there was some concern on the NASA side about these two conflicting with each other in terms of orbits and so forth. There's a little bit of limited communication between NASA and Roscosmos, the Soviet Space Agency. Pretty clear it wasn't going to be a problem. It was their Hail Mary pass to try and grab a lunar sample robotically and bring it home before Apollo could strut its stuff by landing two astronauts on the surface. But unfortunately, as many of their unmanned probes did in that era, it malfunctioned and crashed into the moon.
Wow. So now we're at a time period, as I mentioned, where America hasn't gone back to the moon in a long period of time. But now there's talk about wanting to go back. There's also private companies wanting to go there. Is there another space race with just different players?
It depends on who you ask. You know, if you ask the current administration in Washington, there's a space race based on primarily between the U.S. and China. And there's two things at stake. One is just general leadership in space and the military aspects of that. And the other is about 10 years ago, 15 years ago, we discovered there was water on the moon in the poles for sure, probably elsewhere as well. And, you know, you might think, well, we got lots of water on Earth. What's the big deal? The thing is, it's expensive to launch water. It's thousands of dollars per gallon to launch water into orbit. You need water, whether it's in the form of drinking water or things you can make from it, like breathable oxygen and rocket fuel, ultimately. If you've got that on the moon, you don't have to haul all this stuff with you. You can set up automated manufacturing facilities up there, make oxygen for astronauts or cosmonauts when they arrive, make rocket fuel so you can refuel to come home or go on to Mars, if that's what you have in mind. So there's a lot of interest in the water up there, and that's certainly something the Chinese are working very aggressively towards, and we've been talking about it for a long time but haven't done a whole lot about it other than just robotic reconnaissance from orbit. So now there's an increased interest here. I have to say, it does seem like America seems to be at its best when there's this idea of, hey, somebody else may beat us to it, so let's be competitive. We do continue to have a profound presence in space, but the bursts of activity seem to come when we're afraid we're going to fall behind. And so I think we're seeing that again, particularly in reference to China. Russia hasn't been doing a lot. They've been, of course, supplying us rides to the space station and back, but their space program, while very mature, is not funded very well. It's about a tenth of NASA's budget. And I think once we stop buying rides on the Soyuz spacecraft, the human program is going to probably slow down quite a bit.
Mm. See, I knew if I asked you this question, you'd have the answer.
Or at least lots of opinions. And by the way, if you get a chance, I signed up for the free trial for Apple TV. I'm not sure I'll keep it because there's not a lot there yet. But that show, For All Mankind, is quite good. It's executive produced by Ronald Moore, who was on Star Trek and Battlestar Galactica, both shows which I dipped my toe in, but I never actually got to know him. But he's quite a showrunner, and it's a good show. There's a little bit of a soap opera-ish kind of a quality to it. There's an awful lot of chit-chat and failed romances and frustrated couples and things like that going on. But that was part of the program. It's certainly an interesting diversion in terms of, by the middle of the Apollo program, which by the end of the first season has gone up to Apollo 25, I think, by the middle of it, we've decided, okay, we got to put a military base on the moon because the Russians are trying to do the same thing. So now we have both sides having small military outposts landed on the moon. And at the end of season one, slight spoiler alert here, they sort of sight each other, and it's like, ooh, what's going to happen next? So well worth the watch if you get a chance.
Rod, always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks for being on once again.
Thank you, sir.
NASA expert Rod Pyle, author of First on the Moon, the Apollo 11 50th Anniversary Experience. He's also the author of several titles that you might want to check out, including Space 2.0, How Private Space Flight, A Resurgent NASA and International Partners Are Creating a New Space Age. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the page for this show, which is show number 0537, and you'll find links to Rod's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his books directly. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File Program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio that puts a smile on your face and a skip in your step. Please avoid skipping if you are driving.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about digital life skills for youth. Plus, we'll discuss the power of music. We also have an idiot of the day coming your way and much more Stuff File news here on The Stuff File Program, which is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher and TuneIn, and can also be heard via Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, and Spotify. Just click on the Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify buttons located on the website at thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. And whichever platform you listen to the program on, please feel free to leave a review of the show on their site. It would be greatly appreciated. Well, let's get back to the stuff. An Oregon woman's car was attacked by a 30-year-old man who told police he was battling the evil Morgoth. Morgoth is an evil character created by J.R.R. Tolkien, who is featured in the Lord of the Rings books. Now, Conrad Bass was allegedly high on LSD when he used a sword to attack a woman's car and puncture it. Bass was wearing chainmail with a helmet and carrying a shield during the attack. But the woman was apparently unable to recognize his costume and told the 911 dispatcher that a pirate was attacking her car. Bass told police he was a high elf engaged in the battle with the evil Morgoth, not a pirate. Well, he got the high part right. He also had a staff on him at the time of the attack. Paramedics brought Bass to the hospital after the incident, and he now faces charges of disorderly conduct, criminal mischief, and menacing. What I want to know is, do you think he got high on LSD and then put on the costume? And generally speaking, who has a chainmail outfit and matching helmet and sword and a shield just lying around their house? Just asking. This might be a move only Santa Claus can pull off. An Arizona teen who tried to shimmy down her chimney in an attempt to sneak home after a late night out ended up getting stuck for more than 90 minutes. The teen decided the smokestack would be the best entry to her home after she and her friend, identified only as Yasmin, got locked out and couldn't find another way inside. But the plan soon backfired. She was panicking, Yasmin said. She was like, "Call 911!" She couldn't breathe. The teen screamed for help the entire time. Crews set up a tripod over the chimney and struggled to hoist the girl out. The teen was covered in soot when she was finally freed but refused medical attention. She smiled after she was rescued. The teen's parents rushed home from the movies and were, quote, "really mad," unquote. Yeah, you figure? I'm also guessing she will have a curfew that lasts up until her wedding day. And from the "it seemed like a good idea at the time," not that the last story wasn't in that category, this story comes from a kid with a seriously skewed sense of priorities. Again, not unlike the last story, I guess. A German teen tried to drain an entire pond with water hoses after dropping his iPhone during a fishing trip. The unidentified teen was with other members of an angling club and was not allowed by fellow fishermen to dive into the pond. So he returned hours later with an idea to drain the pond using a pump and two water hoses to direct the water into a nearby toilet. It didn't work. The toilet wasn't connected to the sewage system, so his efforts ended up flooding a parking lot. I knew the phone was probably dead, but wanted to get the data card back with the numbers, pictures, and videos of my friends, he said. The teen now has to pay for damage to the toilet and the cleanup. So, no matter how you cut it, this kid had a crappy day. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Okay, we all know that people shouldn't drink and drive, but when we say that, we're usually talking about someone who has had a few too many and then gets behind the wheel. Rarely are we talking about someone who is literally drinking and driving at the same time. Rarely is it someone who is starting off their workday at 6 a.m. drinking and driving. Rarely are they driving a school bus. A school bus driver from Illinois faces child endangerment charges after police say she drank beer while picking up more than 30 elementary school students. School bus video appears to show the driver, 44-year-old Michelle Passley, drinking beer from a brown paper bag while driving as many as 32 elementary school children. Police say Passley bought two cans of beer the morning of November 15th from a Speedway gas station in Aurora, Illinois at 6 a.m. Officers credited the alert gas station clerk for contacting East Aurora School District 131 after selling beer to the driver and allegedly watching her drive off in the bus. No students were injured in the incident, though parents and investigators are appalled. The school district says it contracts First Student Bus Company for its bus services. After reviewing video, the school bus company fired Passley, and a manager reported the incident to police. Passley was arrested and charged with two misdemeanor counts of endangering the life and health of a child. Now, I've seen the video of Michelle drinking and driving. And by the way, she must have known her bus was equipped with video. But I somehow get the feeling this is not the first time she's had a morning tipple. I wonder if the students on the bus sang some of those typical school bus songs, you know, like the wheels on the bus go round and round, or 100 bottles of beer on the wall. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Angela Crocker is back on the program. In August, we had her on to talk about her book, Digital Legacy Plan, A Guide to the Personal and Practical Elements of Your Digital Life Before You Die. At the time, we mentioned another book that she had, which is Digital Life Skills for Youth, A Guide for Parents, Guardians, and Educators. So we're having her back on to talk about that. Angela joins us via Skype from British Columbia. Hi, Angela.
Well, hello there.
Thanks for being on the program with us once again. Now, I know you have a teenager, and they always say that necessity is the mother of invention. So is that part of the reason why you wrote this book?
Certainly, it is part of the catalyst. I was super frustrated as a parent who's very knowledgeable about technology and social media and how we're living online. And my frustration came in the school talks that were given around kids and technology. And many of them focus on the scary elements. Yes, cyberbullying happens. Yes, youth are being asked to provide nude photographs. Yes, there's catfishing. There's all of these big, big, scary things. However, there was very little day-to-day advice that I had observed. And the reality is that our teenagers need to move from childhood to adulthood and know how to function in terms of technology. We can't protect them from it. So I'd like them to develop those skills. And so I wrote this book to address just that. I do address the dangers, but I also want to talk about the everyday things that they all need to learn in order to function in their day-to-day lives as adults and also in the workforce as they get out into employment.
Well, looking at the future, as you just said, looking down the road when they're getting into the workforce and looking for employment, I guess at the very beginning, one of the questions that has to be asked is, when do you allow your child to have portable technology on them in terms of things like a smartphone? Up is, you know, there's the question of, well, maybe it's too early for child X to have a phone, but by the same token, do you want child X to be behind the curve of knowledge of how to use said phone if they don't have one?
Yes. this is a challenge for every single parent to know when that right moment is. This was another source of frustration for me, was the number of sort of advice gurus, blogs, podcasts that would indicate a particular age. My approach is not age-based. It's based on a number of factors, including your family's approach to technology, the realities of your family situation. Are your kids, are you a split household? Maybe a divorce has happened and you have joint custody. Do you have children with medical needs who need a device to be able to monitor their glucose monitor or track their asthma peak flow meter? The practicalities of their life will partly influence when they can get a device. And then you add on to that their ability to self-regulate, to have the responsibility to look after the device, their ability to communicate. Can they do it effectively, and can they be entrusted with the device? And I don't see it as a one-way decision. If you provide a young person with a device or allow them to purchase one and they abuse the privilege or they're not demonstrating good digital skills, then I would suggest that it can be rolled back. And the age to do this for many families is currently in that sort of grade 6 to 8, age 11 to 13, 14, that kind of window. But one 11-year-old is not going to be as mature as a 13-year-old, or vice versa.
Right. There's a fine line, too, between, I mean, with modern technology, it's an explosion of everything. It's an explosion of information. It's an explosion of entertainment. It's an explosion of social issues. It's all in one. I think back to when I was a kid. You know, there was always that one family in the neighborhood, the one who wasn't allowed to watch television because they didn't have one.
Yes.
And you always thought of them as the weird family. And the ones that were not as socially, that were somewhat socially inept because they didn't have the same social background that all the other kids had. And by the way, that same family, I know some of the members of that family today, some 45 years later, they're still the weird family. I'm just telling you that right now. but that's, you know, the point being, how do you, if you're one of the parents who said your child isn't old enough to have their own television or screen time or whatever the case may be, how do you get around the fact that your child might be socially inadequate compared to the rest of his or her peers?
It creates a real challenge. I mean, socially, they're going to miss out on some of the pop culture clues. They're not going to know about Stranger Things on Netflix, or they're not going to know what the latest album that's hit number one, whatever the music thing is. You know, the status, it varies. But those pop culture references, the memes that are going around, socially, that can put your child in an out-group position, which maybe they're comfortable there, maybe they're not. Of more concern is that for me is the academic impact this might have. If they don't know how to do a Google search, to put in search terms, to identify keywords, to look for the information they need, and then to assess the search engine results in a way that they can choose from reliable sources, acknowledge that there's bias in those sources, be aware of the potential advertising influence on those sources. How can they function well at school and present their schoolwork in a way which is very much driven by online research without those skills developed early on in their teenage years?
Well, one of the things you just described is a problem that adults have too. I mean, we're witnessing this now with the situation that's playing out with, you know, so-called fake news and all those things we hear about that are trying to guide people in a certain direction. You're trying to teach people how to teach their children when in some cases adults aren't aware of some of the things you just described.
Which is very true for so many elements of digital living. And that was partly why I wrote this book, is to describe the notion of fake news, to introduce, I think I talk about a dozen different types of bias that adults may not be aware of. So they learn by reading the book and then have the language and the vocabulary that they need in order to be able to describe examples or illustrate that this is confirmation bias. Those kinds of things are important for adults to learn, and we're all learning. Part of the challenge for parents and teachers and other guardians with working with young people is that this whole notion of being connected 24/7 and having the internet in the palm of our hand or the pocket of our coat is new. It's 10 or 15 years old at best. And so how can we as adults know what to do and pass that on without a little bit of guidance? And those young people, tweens and teens, they're learning best by the behaviors they see modeled by the adults and peers around them.
Is this a book that you want all parents to read and then also hand it to their children to read?
I don't envision that the children will actually read this, although they certainly could. It's very accessible in the way it's written. It's in everyday language. But I envision that this is read by adults who are then picking small lessons from the book and sharing those with tweens and teens over the course of their teenage years. They're not going to pick up all of these skills in a single weekend. Just like we send kids to school to learn math, they start with numbers, they move on to arithmetic, eventually they work their way up to algebra and calculus. Digital skills have a similar progression. And so they have to learn in bits and pieces over a number of years to have those skills that are going to help them translate the internet into the information that's useful to them, to be able to communicate effectively, to be able to maintain social relationships, even to manage their time through a digital calendar.
Is there any difficulty in explaining to your child what you want them to do or not do online, for instance, or what you expect of them, when in most cases that child will already probably be more tech savvy than you, the parent, are?
That is a very big problem for many families. And to help them along the way, I've actually provided with this book a digital contract. There's several different versions. There's a mobile phone contract. There's a classroom digital privileges contract. These contracts are written documents that I recommend they be written, although some families will choose to have a verbal agreement. But by writing these rules down, parents and teachers have the opportunity to be very clear about what their expectations are and what the consequences might be. And by writing them down, families can then refer back to the document and they have something to refer to. My son is now a teenager. He's actually had an internet use contract every year since he was 4 years old when we first started talking about what it meant to be online. Not that he had an online presence when he was four, of course. But he was, you know, watching videos on the Sesame Street channel, for example. And by updating the contract annually, you give your children more privileges over time as they earn them, as they developmentally are able to manage them. And then it also gives you this sort of central point where everybody has a common document to refer to. And that really can help families figure out how to allow technology and how to show the differences. What if you have one child who is 7 years old and another who is 14? 7 years is not an unreasonable gap in a family, but you can't have a one-size-fits-all contract set of rules for every child in your family when the age gap is 7 years. They're going to need different accommodations. They're going to need different freedoms. And so let's make them very clear. And I walk readers through how to do this in the book.
It's another fascinating topic. The book is Digital Life Skills for Youth, and I think a very important subtitle, A Guide for Parents, Guardians, and Educators, because, of course, you want teachers to be involved in this too, because they see the kids for a lot of the waking hours of the day, and it's an important issue that educators will also need to know. Angela, I thank you very, very much for being on the program with us once again.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for including me.
Angela Crocker, author of Digital Life Skills for Youth, A Guide for Parents, Guardians, and Educators. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0537, and you'll find links to Angela's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
Here's a penny for your thoughts from the Stuff File program coming to you from Montreal, Canada, a country that doesn't have pennies.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk to the author of Music is Power, Popular Music, Social Justice, and the Will to Change. We also have an Idiot of the Day coming your way, and more Stuff File news stories here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio, and also on Spotify. And here's another fascinating story featuring Walmart. Police and firefighters in Liberty, Ohio, were called to the Liberty Walmart on the afternoon of November the 16th to find a car on fire in the parking lot. 40-year-old Stephanie Carlson, the driver of the car, told them there was a can of gas in the trunk and she lit a candle to get rid of the smell, but she later admitted that she had poured gas on the seats and started the fire with a lighter because the car was dirty and there was a problem with the front wheel. Okay. The car belonged to her husband, who said he had been looking for her all day and also told officers that she had allegedly been found huffing mothballs and paint thinner recently. Police took her into custody and found a lighter and mothballs in her purse. She was charged with arson, inducing panic, and criminal damage. Now, that's a woman with issues, and also either a bad sense of imagination or the lack of ability to lie. Either way, let's get to our last guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? A couple of years ago, we had Brad Schreiber on the program. That's when he was promoting his book, What Are You Laughing At? How to Write Funny Screenplay Stories and More. Well, he's back with a new book. This one is called Music is Power: Popular Music, Social Justice, and the Will to Change. He joins us on the line right now from California. Hi, Brad.
It's great to be with you again, Peter. Thank you very much.
Nice to have you back on the program with us. So what led to you writing this book? Because, I mean, there's all types of music, of course, and there's all types of reasons as to why people listen to music, but you're being very specific here. Why this topic?
I think it's a combination of my last two books, to be honest with you, Peter. 10 years ago, I wrote Becoming Jimi Hendrix from the research of a Hendrix historian, Steve Roby. And that was about his early career. And then 3 years ago, I wrote Revolution's End, which is the inside story of the formation of the Symbionese Liberation Army, which you'll recall kidnapped Patty Hearst. And that book's all about the CIA and Black Panthers and experiments on black prisoners and very political. So I thought this time, why don't I merge the two?
Well, you know, to paraphrase Dylan, the times they are a-changin'. So I'm just curious to know, in your estimation, if the idea of popular songs being involved in social justice is different now than it was before, in this time when we seem to be so divided and there are people throwing barbs at each other via social media?
Well, I think most people would sadly agree, Peter, that we need more socially conscious music. You know, you think about what's happened to America since Trump took over, and at least half the country is vitriolic, and there isn't a lot of listening to each other. And music has a very special power. Most people don't like politics in the U.S. They don't actually have respect for politicians, but music can impact them enormously, emotionally. And I thought that writing Music is Power might be a way to encourage artists to create this kind of music and for people to take inspiration from socially conscious songs.
Do you think that one of the reasons there is such power to music is because music, generally speaking, or at least popular music, is something that is geared toward and produced by the young who, whatever time period you're looking at, are a group of people who are sometimes ignored by their elders, and it's a way of just gaining their attention and rallying their cry, so to speak?
Yeah, well, music is extremely important when young people are trying to get a sense of their identity as adults. But I would also argue that music works on your consciousness in a way unlike anything else. For example, I can listen to a CD of music that I bought 30 years ago, and I can remember the order of the songs. I can't even remember what I had for breakfast yesterday. So it invades your mind in a completely different way. And there's something very inspiring about seeing people chanting lyrics to a song in a live concert. It has a great power.
Yeah, but by the same token, you know, the things we did when we were younger or by rote are something that stayed with us for a long period of time. I mean, I often start singing songs from when I used to listen to a lot of music when I was a kid, and yeah, can't grasp the songs of what's out there today because my mind is just somewhere else now.
Yeah. Well, let me give you an example of a group that recently has had a profound impact. It's the band Green Day, very hard rock with a punk edge. But when their album, American Idiot, which had an aspect of criticism of the Iraq War, went to Broadway, people were watching that musical who never cared about politics, maybe never even went to a Broadway musical. But their band was talking about what it is to grow up in a society that is driven by war. And that's an excellent example of what we need more, I think, today. It doesn't have to be stridently political, but you should talk about what we're going through. And, of course, American Idiot makes a wonderful connection between the Iraq War and the very sad tragedy of the Vietnamese War.
You talk about what we need today as far as music doing this. Let's go back a little bit with your book. You talk about various groups of people who have had a musical base that is one that shows the power of music. Has that changed over the years? I mean, you know, you list some people, like you go from Pete Seeger to Joan Baez to Peter, Paul and Mary to Marvin Gaye and the Temptations. The list goes on and on and on. And that covers a whole series of years. And you also just mentioned Green Day. How has social activism through music changed in, say, the last 40, 50 years?
Well, the artists you cited to begin with, like Pete Seeger and Joan Baez, they spent their entire lives committed to social justice. Now it becomes an artistic decision. An artist says to the label, look, I normally wouldn't write a political song, but this incident of police brutality or this incident of fracking and polluting water, or this incident is important to me, and I'm going to write a specific song. Then they have to battle the label, and they have to prepare their audiences. So even though there's less of politically conscious music today, Peter, in a way it has an even greater effect because of social media. And in Music is Power, I also talk about Bob Marley, Peter Gabriel. These guys, their music has gone around the world. They are ambassadors for political change all over the world.
And what about the difference between the person who is the voice of the music, literally, the artist, and the person who is the writer? And I bring that up because I mentioned a couple of Motown artists, and I'll toss another one in there. Marvin Gaye, The Temptations, Edwin Starr. They had great songs that dealt with social injustice and or war. But in the case of Marvin Gaye, that was coming from him. In the case of The Temptations, it was coming from Norman Whitfield, the writer.
That's right.
So is there a difference when you have a social issue being expressed by the artist as opposed to just being transmitted by the artist?
Well, so there are two different issues here, because Marvin Gaye had to battle Berry Gordy at Motown and threaten to not put out any more music if he didn't get to do What's Going On. Now, Norman Whitfield, God love him, I'm so glad that he wanted to do Psychedelic Soul and Ball of Confusion and all these other interesting socially conscious songs. But the other side of Norman Whitfield is he went, hey, everybody's into this political stuff, why don't we try it too? And it made money. So it's a real interesting blend of being socially conscious and also saying, hey, you're not going to lose money on this. This is going to attract a lot of people. And that's part of the process of the marketing of socially conscious music. You can't sing about something that isn't also going to do well for the bottom line of the corporation.
And I would say the difference now in socially conscious music of today as opposed to of the past is you might have a Woody Guthrie or a Pete Seeger talking about issues that are important to them, but are not necessarily really part of their daily living. But today you seem to have musical artists who everything they write, whether it's socially conscious or not, seems to be in some way, shape, or form autobiographical.
It is sometimes autobiographical, and in a way it becomes less strident if a musical artist talks about their experience. There are, of course, exceptions to every rule. I think of Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young singing Ohio. Kent State, of course, the terrible shooting on the campus. They weren't there, but in reading about it in a Life magazine, it was instantaneous. You know, it was like, let's go into the studio right now and do something about these kids being murdered by the National Guard. So that was, in a sense, their personal reaction to something that they really had to address. They couldn't live with the idea of not doing a song about that violence at Kent State. And it's considered one of the great political protest songs of all time.
You grew up with many of the artists that are listed in your book. Is there anybody who stands out as far as you're concerned who, when you heard a particular song, changed your mind or thoughts on a particular issue or situation?
Well, there are a number of them. I can tell you that there are people that I got to know. I worked with Frank Zappa, and he gets his own chapter in Music is Power. A really brilliant guy, and people shouldn't forget that he put up his own money to fight the Parents Music Resource Center, which was proposing censorship of music. And I thought that was a pretty brave stance. There's another guy people don't generally know, Peter, named P.F. Sloan, Phil Sloan, who wrote Eve of Destruction. And you'll read in that chapter that he had a really hard time after writing a number one hit song because it was so on the nose that even other members of the rock and roll community condemned the song for not being subtle enough. But clearly, it rang a bell for a lot of people. It meant a lot. So P.F. Sloan is kind of a tragic but important figure. And I know when I heard Eve of Destruction as a very young man in Northern California, it really reached me. You may go up for 4 days in space, but when you come down, it's the same old place. He was condemning NASA and the money put into the space program instead of trying to fix the things in the U.S.
Well, the book itself is a very powerful topic. The book is Music is Power. Brad, I thank you once again for being on the program with us.
It's always a pleasure, and thank you, Peter.
Brad Schreiber, author of Music is Power, Popular Music, Social Justice, and the Will to Change. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0537, and you'll find links to Brad's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. And if you'd like to listen to the previous conversation I had with Brad, you can go to the archives for the Stuff File program at thestufffile.com and look for episode number 0424, which was from the first week of October in 2017. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for the Idiot of the Week. of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
A speedster father and son duo from New Jersey was busted for drag racing in the Lincoln Tunnel after the son posted a video of their high-speed Corvette contest. The dashboard video shows 25-year-old Chadwick Quinones of West Milford speeding in a black Corvette through the northern tube in the Lincoln Tunnel into Manhattan, zooming past buses and cars at around 10 p.m. way back on February 9th. At one point, a yellow Corvette driven by Quinones's 44-year-old father can be seen trying to pass him, at which point the son loses control and spins out in the tunnel. Both fled the scene before cops arrived, and cops issued three summonses to Quinones. Quinones turned himself into the police about an hour and a half after the crash and was slapped with charges of leaving the scene of an accident, failure to exhibit registration, and careless driving. Again, this was all back in February. But Port Authority police only realized Quinones was racing his dad after the son recently posted a video to Instagram of the drag race. Both were then arrested on charges of reckless endangerment in the first degree, illegal speed contest, and reckless driving. Now, why, oh why, after getting a slap on the wrist for just leaving an accident, would you actually post on Instagram that you and your pinhead father were racing Corvettes through the Lincoln Tunnel? One reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0537. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0537. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. A tape of the preceding program will be sent to the Radio Hall of Fame, where it will be placed under the statue of Marconi, which is kind of wobbly.